Welcome to Already Perfect, the Seattle Soto Zen podcast. And I needed a push to get me to see. Wherever I am, I'm already free.
What a pleasure. Thank you for asking me to lead off this series. Can you all hear me okay? Okay, good. Well, good evening, Noble Sangha. It's wonderful. I was scrolling through all the little boxes of windows, seeing all of you. Wonderful to be back to Seattle Soto Zen. And Kanchen, I need to ask you, how long do I have?
You have until Zazen usually ends. So we'll end at the regular time of 7:15 with the four Bodhisattva vows.
Okay. I ask that because I presented this talk to Prairie Mountain Zen Center and it went a little long. So I think I will edit as I go along. This talk is on ancestors and koans, because we have just kicked off a fall class on that subject. And we're using this book, Making Zen Your Own, by Janet Juryu Abels. Making Zen Your Own is a lovely book from 2012. And she also had to give talks about the ancestors, which is how the book came about, came into being. And so when we come to Zen practice, often we carry ideas or images in our heads. Rows of monks robed in black, sitting in stillness and silence. Entering the Zendo the first time, we may wonder at the quiet, the lack of verbal instruction, the sense that something is happening, but we aren't sure exactly what. Sticking around longer, we are gradually exposed to various Zen ancestors, as well as the famous Zen stories or koans. Yet we may wonder what these old figures and stories have to do with us or our practice. Mystery shrouds both koans and ancestors, partly due to style and cryptic concision. It's helpful to remember that Chinese Chan monks were immersed within this intensely poetic culture, and they were well-educated as well, as we see in a figure like Dogen years later. Even so, koans and koan practice are profoundly challenging, as exemplified by the stories themselves, when frequently a monk or a student misses the lesson, leaving us to puzzle it out. This sense of mysterious puzzle permeates koans and koan practice, enhancing our difficulty and our anxiety. But in many ways, this is deliberate. A highly structured methodology in Zen practice that compels students to confront the koan through short phrases and through constant concentration, eventually to awaken into an appropriate response. At the same time, students meet the ancestors, including Buddha himself, the first patriarch, Bodhidharma, the sixth ancestor, Huainan, and a host of other ancestors whose journeys of awakening and practice challenges encourage us along the way. One classic Zen expression says, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. This statement attempts to reorient a student practitioner towards Buddha nature within. Externalizing Buddha misses the mark, as the story of Xuefeng's awakening illustrates. Don't you know? What comes in through the front gate isn't the family treasure. If you want to express the great teaching, it must flow out from your breast. At Brother Yantou's words, Xuefeng awakened, and together they danced in the mountain pass as the snow swirled and fell. Modern Zen students and practitioners are no different, feeling puzzled or as if they're always falling short. This sense of doubt or lack can feel pervasive, even corrosive, as if our practice was insufficient, as if we ourselves are deeply inadequate or unworthy. The ancestors seem so deeply profound and realized that a perception of difference arises within us, a gap between seeming self and other. Perhaps the biggest gap between Buddha and ourselves. And yet the instruction from later Mahayana Buddhism states, we are all endowed with intrinsic Buddha nature. It is never apart from one, right where one is. So writes Dogen early in the 13th century. At the same time, though, we may not feel our intrinsic Buddha nature, may feel very distant from realization, liberation, awakening, or enlightenment. This tension runs through each and every practitioner and frequently drives Zen students to develop and deepen their right effort, a powerful determination to wake up and realize the Buddha way. It is helpful to remember that Gautama was himself dissatisfied with his life, despite being raised in a protected, privileged atmosphere in the royal palace, inheritor of privilege and prosperity. Like many of us, he felt this dissatisfaction so keenly that he left the nest and began earnest exploration. In this respect, our own dissatisfaction manifests as a spur, sparking us onwards. At the same time, it is not so easy to relax into our dukkha, accept the suffering that comes to us, even as we aim to orient ourselves towards more deeply committed practice. This is when Buddha encounters the four signs, three of which are experiences of profound suffering: old age, sickness, death. And yet the last spurred him in a different way. A shining, bright-eyed monk who modeled the way of the spiritual journey. Even so, his encounters with old age, sickness, and death are profoundly traumatic. Just like Koshin Kane's talk last Sunday immersed us in our sorrow, our loss. Just because we put on a robe doesn't mean it's somehow a bulletproof vest. If anything, we open ourselves to feeling more fully and more keenly. This pushes us forward our path. Even as Gautama sets off on his spiritual exploration, we witness his great difficulties and disappointments. His efforts at philosophical study hit a wall. His efforts at asceticism bring him to death's door. He despairs. He doesn't know which way to go. Only after reaching this low point does Gautama recall his childhood moment of clarity sitting beneath the tree. Only after receiving a bowl of porridge from the girl who saw him suffering and dying beside the river does he come back to his practice and discern the middle way. Like all of us, he needed support. A Buddha's story seems like that of a great isolated spiritual hero. But he too was held in the broader arms of the Mahasangha. He too was emerging out of deep India's wide array of different approaches to spiritual inquiry. And those functioned, as he gave himself over to exploration, as guidelines, as sort of exploratory boundaries that helped him. When he tried one, he tried another on his path of discovery. This recollection in tranquility, as Wordsworth would call it, recalling this moment of clarity and insight, sitting upright as a child, led him into the middle way, the upright sitting in cross-legged position, breathing naturally and calmly in silence and stillness. Our great Buddha ancestors are human beings just like ourselves, suffering and struggling in the wheeling world of samsara. In the stories, we see them struggle openly, while in others, we meet them after enlightenment. And they have encounters with other people who suffer greed, anger, and delusion, desire, hatred, and ignorance. Bodhidharma's encounter with Emperor Wu exemplifies this kind of story. In this first scene of Blue Cliff Record, Bodhidharma manifests as fully realized embodiment of awakened Buddha nature, yet is cryptically curt and concise in his replies to the emperor's searching questions. He responds, "No merit, nothing holy, and I don't know." His unyielding, relentless temperament sets the tone and image of Zen for centuries. It presents as an uncompromising school within which students may struggle to see their teacher as Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of compassion. This teacher may seem so stern, so untouchable. And yet, realizing his mistake, feeling deep regret, Emperor Wu tries to send an emissary to bring the first ancestor back. But his attendant explains, it's too late. This koan leaves the student reader with regret. We don't want to miss the lesson either. And we may need to open our hearts and our eye of practice to understand Zen's instructions and teachers when they manifest a different kind of compassionate response. If Bodhidharma sets Zen precedent for fierce, uncompromising effort, sixth ancestor Huainang provides us with an everyman image. He's kind of an every person an illiterate woodsman from the barbarian south. He overhears a stanza from Diamond Sutra and immediately awakens to the nature of mind. Somehow, his life, his karma prior to that, chopping wood, carrying water, he somehow has an inner attunement. So when he hears this gatha on the road from a passing monk, it hits him like a lightning bolt. He inquires where he might learn more and is directed up the mountain. The fifth ancestor's temple, over there. Of course, upon arrival, he's sent to the kitchen and told to pound rice for 9 months. In this story, we see his determination to awaken coexist with innate Buddha nature. Just as the Buddha instructs, awakening and enlightenment are not exclusive by caste, intelligence, social class, educational background. As Dogen expresses it in Fukan Zazengi, intelligence or lack of it does not matter. Between the dull and sharp-witted, there is no distinction. If you concentrate your effort single-mindedly, that in itself is negotiating the way. Practice realization is naturally undefiled. Going forward in practice is a matter of everydayness. In Platform Sutra, we meet the mystery of Huainong's early attunement to the Dharma. In many respects, it's unfathomable as to why he is attuned this way, just as it is for ourselves, how we came to Zen at all. But he does reflect, he does receive the words of the Diamond Sutra. He does go to Hongren's monastery. And this helps us reflect on our own stubbornness, slowness, and resistance. Huainong's story illustrates humble persistence despite challenging circumstances. His story ultimately exemplifies a confidence in one's intrinsic Buddha nature, the seeds of which are also revealed in Buddha's own journey of awakening. And we see him with a deeply intuited faith in his capacity to awaken. Checking the time here. I think I'm going to skip forward. We want to believe in ourselves, have faith in ourselves. Yet often we're stuck, deluded about the nature of our minds and hearts. In times of crisis, we fall into habits of unawakened mind and suffer more deeply. Yet Juryu Janet Abels, in her book, Making Zen Our Own, tells us that the Chinese symbol for crisis is the same as that for opportunity. She clarifies the deep value of this perspective and encourages its development as essential in our spiritual journey. We as Zen practitioners always have the opportunity, she writes, to either label what is happening as difficult, failure, or crisis, or not to label it at all and instead see it as just this. And this view of reality without labels allows for all kinds of possibilities to arise if we could only trust the moment. Developing this trust is the work of Zen. Modern Zen ancestor Thich Nhat Hanh embodies this kind of right understanding in his own determined efforts to awaken. Even in the midst of the Vietnam War and his own loss of statehood and citizenship due to his involvement in protesting the war and presenting at the Paris Peace Talks, 1968, Ty's passport was invalidated. Applying to the French government for asylum, he became apatride, a stateless person. While it did enable him to travel to European countries, it walled him out from Canada and the United States, except in the case of having a proper visa. Yet, it is very difficult to apply for a visa as a stateless person. He would be turned down as a matter of course. This compelled him to practice even more deeply. He says, "My practice was the practice of mindfulness. I tried to live in the here and now and touch the wonders of everyday life. It was thanks to this practice I survived. The expression, 'I have arrived, I am home,' is the embodiment of my practice." The suffering Ty encountered as a 40-year-old monk was profound. And it was this excruciating exile that compelled him to awaken more completely. In At Home in the World, he describes this. "When we are deeply in touch with present moment, we can touch both the past and the future. If we know how to handle present moment properly, we can heal the past. It was precisely because I did not have a country of my own that I had the opportunity to find my true home. This is very important. It was because I didn't belong to any particular country that I had to make an effort to break through and find my true home. The feeling that we are not accepted, that we do not belong anywhere and have no national identity, can provoke the breakthrough necessary for us to find our true home." With Zen practice, we face the wall and go into the dark. The austerity and intensity appeal because they legitimate the practice. We meet ourselves. We meet the ancestors. Zen Master Zhao Zhou asked two arrivals, "Have you been here before?" "No, I haven't." "Go have some tea," Zhao Zhou answered. To the second, he asked, "Have you been here before?" "Yes." "Go have some tea." The head monk overheard and asked, "Why did you tell each of them the same thing?" "Head monk, go have some tea." With Zhao Zhou, we encounter an iconoclastic yet deeply humble ancestor. He entered the monastery young and ordained as a novice, and yet he sought greater depth and breadth and journeyed far on pilgrimage before he came upon Master Nanquan in remote seclusion on a faraway mountain. Waking up with Nanquan, he practiced together with his teacher 30 years. After Nanquan died, Zhao Zhou goes on 20 more years of pilgrimage, only settling in a rickety, run-down, ramshackle temple that he refused to upgrade. His simplicity and humility embodies in practice. The mystery of our spiritual journey manifests in its unfolding. And this is why we conclude with Fayan, who illustrates that the practice of Zen is our entire life. Modern psychologist and Zen teacher Barry Magid makes the point another way. He states, "Every insight is partial, requires long years of integration." Fayan's own journey centers on pilgrimage. Like Zhao Zhou, he wanders far and wide. Finally, he leaves his monk friends in a snowstorm, enters the monastery, meets the teacher one-on-one at Dokusan. "Where are you going?" asked the teacher. "Around, on pilgrimage." "Why do you go, monk?" "I don't know." "Ah, not knowing. Most intimate." opening into the unadorned freshness this moment, we see it is right here, not out there on the summit of some impossibly distant peak. Yet it may take us years, like Basho wandering across the Shirakawa barrier into the remote north. For our journey runs counter to conventional mind. Studying the ancestors and their stories is essential in Zen practice, but it is only a part of our training, and it cannot be solely an intellectual pursuit. Rather, it must be combined with all the other elements, starting with Zazen, incorporating Sesshin, training in lay temple with everyday people like ourselves, taking our training into work, into our families, into our homes, into the monastery for residential training, and out again on that long road that leads to integration of practice at the deepest level of our being. From earliest times, there have always been some who perished along the road. Still, I have always been drawn by wind-blown clouds into dreams of a lifetime of wandering. The moon and sun are eternal wanderers. Even the years wander on. A lifetime adrift in a boat, or in old age leading a tired horse into the hills. Every day is a journey, and the journey itself is home.
And I needed a push to get me to see. Wherever I am, I'm already free.
Thank you for listening. Please find us at SeattleSotoZen.org. Our theme music is by Stuart Davis. Gosho!